we're trying to get to a point where feeding 9 billion people at 2050 needs to be sustainable. And in order to do that, we need to have sustainable crops that are not taking from the planet health, but actually helping sequester things like carbon dioxide from the environment. The reality is that the easiest way to do that, and I know you've seen the great documentary called Kiss the Ground, which goes into detail on this, is essentially by growing plant crops that can help. You know, leaving crops in the ground, less tilling, less water usage, and ultimately more soil health, which means that we need to use less land to grow more volume to feed more people. And like, it's incredibly simple, but the practices that are going on in the agriculture community because of the lack of education are the opposite to this. In the US in particular, there's approximately 40% of all fresh produce bought in the store is thrown in the bin, which is absolutely disastrous. And if you buy frozen vegetables to replace those fresh vegetables, you're getting the nutrition, but you're also taking an average of a pound of fresh food waste out of the waste system. So it's basically one for one on replacement of making a difference to food waste and planet health. The big retailers are great at following what the consumer trend is because they have the data to understand what's important to their shopper base, and that's what they exist to be, you know, to serve the consumer. If you look at Waitrose and Sainsbury's, for example, they've created a B Corp aisle because they know that that's important to their consumers. So can an aisle become a supermarket? Well, if the aisle or the section didn't exist before, then why not? In terms of timing, you know, I think it becomes about when things start getting complicated for us in terms of global temperature. These things are warning signs of change. And, you know, unfortunately, we as a race of people don't do anything until it's right in front of us and causing a problem.
I have a fantastic thought leader being interviewed today. His name is Sam Denigan, and he's from Strong Roots. Hey, Sam, how you doing?
Hey, Anand. Thanks for having me. Good to see you.
Yeah, good to see you too. And I know we've been discussing for a while, and it's been great having these chats with you, and great to have you on the show, especially that you're such a leading authority now in the world of frozen food. And we're going to be hearing some more about that. And I was really happy that you also got your B Corp status. And I'm also a fan of your products. There's some of your potato fries in my freezer right now.
Awesome. Thanks for the custom. Keep that freezer filled.
Yeah, for sure. So let's talk about that. I mean, a couple of years ago, I did have this debate with my wife about, you know, fresh food and frozen food. And then she was saying, yeah, it's always great to buy frozen because it packs the nutritional value. And I always thought, well, does it? I thought it might lose stuff, but she's right, you know, it does pack a lot of nutritional value. But there's also a big thing about food waste right now. And obviously we have to be careful about what we're buying and make sure we're consuming that. So it'd be great to, I guess, just start with that point and actually if you can sort of tell us a little bit more about why it's good to have frozen, you know, freshly picked veg.
Absolutely. They are the two main benefits of frozen foods. You've hit the nail on the head. So, you know, the first being kind of wrapped around the technology of IQF, which is individually quick frozen, which basically means that when you pick whole vegetables off the fields, it's possible to immediately freeze those to lock in all the nutrition that's there, as opposed to shipping them in the fresh market, which over a case of, you know, 6 to 8 weeks, basically there's degradation on the nutrition that's in there. And by the time it reaches your local supermarket in the fresh aisle, it's got much less nutrition in than it did when it came off the plant. And that's been, you know, a scientifically proven case for years. I think the initial research on that was done on frozen peas, probably by the likes of Bird's Eye or one of the companies that it benefits. And we're actually looking at a similar type of research at the moment to prove that against root vegetables and all the things that are in the strong roots range. The second thing, as you rightly mentioned, is about food waste. We did a study a couple of years ago, which basically revealed that in the US in particular, there's approximately 40% of all fresh produce bought in the store is thrown in the bin, which is absolutely disastrous. And if you buy frozen vegetables to replace those fresh vegetables, you're getting the nutrition, but you're also taking an average of a pound of food waste, of fresh food waste, out of the waste system. So it's basically one for one on replacement of making a difference to food waste and planet health. So buying frozen is definitely a benefit. Now, the reality is that people's perception of fresh produce is never going to change. But you know, having, as we talked about previously, that backup in the freezer for those times when you're looking to manage portion control, or you just don't need a whole head of broccoli, or you just don't need a whole bag of potatoes. Buying frozen is the perfect answer to those situations.
Yeah, for sure. And it's definitely about convenience if it's already, you know, cut to the right sizes, et cetera.
Of course. Well, I mean, look, we've become a group of consumers that need everything done for them, which is why Strong Roots exists in the first place. You know, we've always seen ourselves as the Sherpa for the consumer. You know, you be the hero, you climb the mountain, we'll do all the hard work for you, and we'll make you look good. So all of the convenience around frozen is based on it being easy to do, which is one of the key pillars of our North Star.
Yeah, very good. So one of the things, you know, when I've spoken to, I guess, startups that are looking to make frozen products, and I think it's more a few companies who want to create, say, frozen ready meals, for example, I don't know, a frozen burrito or some sort of breakfast dish. And one of the things, having spoken to some other investors, has been about the supply chain, especially if you're delivering it to the consumer. So, one is that obviously the packing and the temperature has to be the right temperature, but the big one is also around logistics, obviously, with the delivery trucks and all that. You've gone obviously direct to the retailers, but what's your opinion about more of the supply chain and delivery side, both within you know, the super large supermarket chains, but also people who are trying to create a direct consumer product that may be bigger, you know, boxes that may have more items within that box, for
Sure.
example? Yeah.
Sure. Yeah, the supply chain question is very complicated, especially around frozen. You know, one thing I would say, and I don't have a number to share, but I'll follow up with you, is that the supply chain of shipping frozen food and the carbon that's used in that process specifically is dwarfed by food waste. So if we're to try and pick one over the other, the food waste problem is significantly larger than the shipping and supply chain problem on frozen food in particular. With things like D2C, it gets more complicated. You know, the main shipping channel of direct to consumer frozen food is by carbon dioxide or dry ice. There is no better shipping method for temperature control in that industry than carbon dioxide. And that's one of the reasons that we've been hesitant to jump in with 2 feet before understanding what the actual carbon impact is, because, you know, our objective is obviously to make food better and improve the food system and supply chain. If we jump into D2C without understanding what the actual relevance of change that that's going to create to our carbon footprint, it, you know, we could be swapping one thing for one bad thing for another. So
Yes.
it's complicated.
So was that actually one of your decisions, or have you actually been considering also D2C?
We are, and we're planning to actually launch a beta test in North America within the next 6 to 12 months. We've been working on our proposition for the last couple of years. There's been a lot of market entrants serving various different consumer bases. And one of the things that we wanted to understand is where we fit, what's missing, what's the consumer proposition that no one else has tackled yet. We think that's close to value and convenience over doing meal replacement, but that's something we're still working out, and we're adapting lots of our product portfolio in order to be able to cater to what a holistic delivery package to a consumer looks like. The other thing that we're very conscious of, and it kind of led us to our B Corp certification a couple of years ago, is ultimately what our climate footprint is. And if I know you're based in the UK, so if you go down to your local Waitrose or Tesco, you'll see some of our products now actually have our B Corp logo on the front,
yeah,
but also our climate footprint on the front of the pack, which I believe we're the first company to do in such an obvious manner. Lots of people are now illustrating what their climate footprint is on back of pack. We've decided to put it front and center. And the reason for that is because whether good or bad, we want to put it out there to make people understand that we're constantly trying to improve. So going from, you know, low density polyethylene to card, understanding what the footprint effect of that is, and now looking at the D2C channel and understanding what we're putting into the supply chain by using carbon dioxide to ship the product. And, you know, sometimes as a result of availability, you see a lot of the D2C companies starting off with compostable materials and things that are natural and things that can break down easy. But during the pandemic, as I was testing all the various different D2C channels, I started getting polystyrene. I started getting plastics. I started getting things because there is not enough resources to deliver the amount of consumer demand that's out there.
Yeah, so, and you've also got the cost, right? I mean, the cost of packaging for a brand that's a new entrant is going to be a lot cheaper going the other way than buying sustainable packaging. But I think if that's a core ethos of the company, it should be followed, shouldn't it? And we should kind of be making it easier for startups to sort of afford to go the right way with also their packaging.
Yeah, this is, I suppose, a complete counterculture thing to say, but one of the reasons why we've been able to lean into bricks and mortar retailers so much is because they're efficiently consolidating a location and a distribution channel for people to purchase large-scale variety of products and food, beverage, et cetera, et cetera. And ultimately, that's how the industry moved at a time when people wanted more variety of things under the one roof. The huge disruption of that is obviously brands wanting to speak to their consumers directly, and a whole supply chain being created in order for them to do that. But inefficiently relative to how efficiently various different big retailers have put a huge amount of effort and investment into building environmentally sustainable distribution centers and supply chains, etc. So as we invest in one thing, we're creating another thing to basically be abrasive against it. And everyone's kind of trying to understand where the catalyzing of D2C during the pandemic is going. Is it stabilized? Is it continuing to grow? There's no doubt that e-commerce is becoming more and more prevalent and people are buying more and more online. But is it becoming efficient or less efficient as a result of how we're doing it? Now, obviously, frozen is an anomaly in that because of its energy usage in the supply chain. But a lot of ambient or dry goods and brands have benefited from skipping that step of the retailer. But retail and the bricks and mortar environment has really worked for us because we're able to categorize how the consumer shop, what consumer discovery looks like, and ultimately having a relationship with and the data that comes with that relationship to understand where to go next. So it's a good debate. It's a difficult one.
Yeah. Staying on the B Corp topic, great news, obviously, that you've got that status. And also you mentioned there about the carbon labeling as well. We need more consumer products to have the correct labeling on their products. Can you just talk a little bit, first of all, just on the process to get the certification with B Corp?
Sure. B Corp is obviously a community of companies and organizations who are focused on, you know, this idea of a triple bottom line. So people, planet, and profit. Three being equal elements in a company's development or the organization's development. The reason that's important to us is because since the beginning, certification or not, we always decided that we wanted to be a company who did things in the right way. And that's because we're pushing and challenging big food to be better. You know, the goal is to improve the food system. So therefore, you know, we're not overwoke to that sense. You've got to run a business. You've got to use things that in order to get started are unsustainable, because if you want scale, you have to fall in line with the supply chains that exist. But then as we got scale, we wanted to do things better than everybody else. So in year two or three, we took the decision to, look at how we could join a community of other companies who were, in our view, doing business in the right way, which wasn't pure capitalism, but what's been kind of coined as conscious capitalism.
Which companies were you considering at that time?
One of the kind of main flags for us would have been Oatly, and how they were kind of, positioning themselves as a brand that was conscious of the effects that they were having on an industry. For the longest time, I've been a huge advocate of companies like Innocent, which is how we built a lot of our product proposition on, who are one of the bigger B Corp inclusions, particularly in Ireland, but also in the UK. And then if you look at even businesses like Kroger in the US, for example, large supermarket chains, who are looking at how to benefit that triple bottom line at the same time, are all members of B Corp in different ways. I also have a small investment in a company called Feed that operates in the UK and Ireland.
Yeah, he actually came on the show, by the way. Great guy.
Shane's great.
Shane,
I'm speaking to him later on. We actually have a board meeting.
But, tell him I say hello.
I will indeed. And one of the key reasons that I was interested in their company and helping them out is because of their same commitment. So for me, you know, it's easy to see opportunities when you're in the food business. You get a lot of opportunities to look at and invest in companies and stuff. But unless they're, you know, striving for the same thing, it doesn't interest me. So B Corp has been important. The process is by assessment. So there's a big questionnaire and you fill out the questionnaire incredibly honestly. It's very difficult in the assessment not to state what your future hopes are for the company, because it makes you realize what you're not. And actually, that's an important part of it. So you fill out the questionnaire, and I can't remember what the baseline is. I think it's like 80, 83, 85, somewhere around there, of a point system, which you must be over in order to apply for certification. And for a lot of it, I think we had sufficiently already established our company in the way it should be in terms of focusing on sustainability and our carbon footprint and the types of products that we sell ultimately are assistive in that whole process. The things I think that a lot of startups don't have is the diversity and inclusion elements. When you're building a startup, you're focused on growth and nothing else, you know, not a fairness and equality element to how your organizational structure works. Inclusion and diversity at board level, at senior executive level, making sure that people are healthy and well. Is there enough time off? Have they been considered in terms of career development? So it really is a holistic view of how you run the business and a very, very positive forward-looking view around which, if a lot of companies did it, how commerce would be much more improved. So it's an assessment followed by an audit and ultimately certification. And now recertification can happen, I think, every 3 or 5 years. I'm not up to date on my B Corp rules. But one of the other things that we did to really kind of commit to the process was actually adopt in our company constitution the commitment to B Corp and what it stands for. So the actual rules that govern the company from a board level have adopted legal inclusion as well. So we're kind of we're actually bound by it, which is an important part for us, but also for our recent new investor and shareholder in McCain as well.
Yeah. And we'll come to McCain in a minute. Are you using any specific tools to help you do your carbon reporting? Any technology tools, etc.?
Yeah, there's a great company. I think they're based in Sweden, but I think they're based in Sweden. I'll stand to be corrected, and apologies to them if they're not, called Carbon Cloud. Carbon Cloud is a cloud-based reporting system, basically, by which we use their tools and database to account for the amount of climate footprint there is on each product. So if you look at the metrics on the front of the packs of our new products, that has all been calculated by Carbon Cloud. And the good thing about Carbon Cloud is it's also a database where you can go on and see any of the companies that are part of that program. You can go on and audit and compare and contrast where they sit. I know Oakley is another company who uses that, but it's quite significant, and the team over there really, really helpful.
Yeah, and they've had it for a long time. I've seen their packaging have that, so they have definitely been leading the way in terms of that, making that reporting basically transparent to the consumers. What can be done on what I don't have is, I guess, a touch point on what the consumers are thinking, and are they now wanting to have this data available to them? Will it actually inform their future decisioning of purchasing certain products or not? Because that's what we should be driving towards, I guess.
Yeah. The answer is it's a very, very, very small group of people, but ultimately growing. And the younger the generation of consumer is, the more interested they are in climate impact of their products. And they are making choices on brands which are conscious of these topics. But the reality is that it's still super, super, super small. But I think the same goes for veganism. You know, veganism has been a, hundreds of years process in the making of popular culture, which it's now at the absolute peak of. And I think, you know, there's always a good reason to keep banging the drum about why it's better to do this and why we should illustrate these things so that they eventually become normal state of play. So while it is very small, it's still very, very important. And we want to be part of the leadership that make it more obvious over a longer space of time.
Yeah, and it also makes you more unique.
Yeah, I mean, look, we there's no point in standing aside from the fact that it is part of our marketing strategy. It's part of who we want to be, but it's also part of how we want to connect with people. And what we want to first people to understand about our brand is that it tastes great. We're a taste-first brand. Everything else comes after that. We have a 6 strong seed strategy of how we develop products, and each of those points have to be met, one of which being sustainability, and how we communicate about how we do things better. You know, we don't have vast vertically integrated agriculture projects and manufacturing facilities that we can, I suppose, talk about the journey of the food, even though we have great partners that do. The difference that we make is making brands work harder and better for planet, people, and ultimately leading to profit. And that's our role, you know, in improving the food system.
Yeah, awesome. And thinking about McCain now, so you closed on your investment, which was, I think, one of the largest food investments in Europe at, was it $55 million US? Or
that's right. That's yeah. Right, yeah.
And so it's been a few months now since you've got that investment. Can you tell us what has changed? Like, what have you used that investment for? And as a result of getting that investment, it'd be great to hear a little bit more on the marketing side and what other areas you'll be investing for future growth.
So we're currently in planning mode and pretty much have been since we closed that investment round at the start of December last year. I think one of the biggest investments that we've made so far is in people, to put the foundation in for what will be a period of much more incremental growth for us. The second biggest bucket of investment that we've made thus far is in R&D. So we currently sit in, depending on what way the retailers cut it up, maybe two or three categories within frozen food. And our outward sort of pipeline of products and categories is probably another seven on top of that over a kind of a 5 to 10 year period. So we've been investing heavily in R&D to understand what comes next. The next tranche of our investment is going to be in specific regional growth to back that pipeline. So we're obviously still an emerging brand in the US market. We've got nationwide distribution with a number of chains to date, I think nearly about 5,000 stores. We've also invested in research on which other geographical territories that we're going to launch within the next couple of years. Yeah. Our objective alongside improving the food system is to globalize the brand and have it available for approximately 10% of the global population within the next five years. So we've got a lot of road to walk, and ultimately that they're the three main areas where we'll be focusing on.
Yeah,
the internationalization of the brand, people, and R&D for the most part.
Yeah. So let's touch on the big one, the people question. Which sort of departments, and can you tell me a little bit more about, I guess, the senior leadership team as well within Strong Roots?
Yeah. Yeah, so we have a global strategy team, which functions as leadership for the business. It's myself, my COO, Fergal McGarry, who's a lifelong career in CPG companies. Maria Kennedy, who's our group head of marketing, who is formerly from the fashion industry, but has come over to the plant-based nice. Food industry to try and use some of their strategy and ways of reach.
You know, that's probably a good idea, because, you know, some of the best ads, also when you look at like attention metrics, are sort of luxury brand ads that are quite simple, but just like really effective at standing out. Yeah. And like, you know, animation and stuff like that to capture your eye. So, yeah, maybe.
I literally had the same conversation with our creative director. We've just brought a new creative director into the business, a lady called Annie Havlin, who comes from the beauty industry. And yeah. we had the same conversation, which was it all starts, you know, cultural trend and engagement all starts with fashion and beauty. So ultimately, you know, doing more like what they do brings you closer to emerging trend than everything else, which is just follow on copy or me too versions of that. So whether it's color palette or photography style or, you know, just a new channel or way of promoting things, that's what they're designed for. So taking a leaf out of their book is what we're doing right now.
I would probably add music as well to maybe that list.
Are they one and the same now? And that's a debate.
Quite true.
Maria comes to us from Coach, and then Hanno Dedene is a Belgian guy who works for us as head of product R&D, and our CFO Chris Burkle make up the global strategy team. And what we've been doing as a newly formed group pretty much since the start of the year is trying to pave out what comes next. What are the right decisions to make? Where should we try and win? And how do we want to do it at the same time as keeping our B Corp principles and making sure that we're doing it in the right way?
Yep. And so let's talk about where you want to go next. Obviously, you've got your range of frozen food that's actually a huge number of locations. You mentioned 5,000 retail stores in the US, right?
That's in the US. Yeah, we're probably in around 9,000 to 10,000 stores as a group across the globe now.
Could you mention your retailers that you're in today?
Yeah, so the major retailers in Ireland are like Super Value, Dunnes Stores, Tesco, which obviously bridges over into the UK as well. We trade with most of the majors in the UK. We started with Waitrose, then moved to Tesco. We were at Sainsbury's, Asda, Morrisons. We've done some business with Iceland in the past, just about to do some more, hopefully. And we're very proudly the first frozen brand to go to Marks & Spencer shelves. They were previously not. They were a private label specialist, obviously, up until a few years ago. And that was a big one for me because Marks & Spencer has been a huge part of, you know, the fanciest place to go to do your shop for years. And then shortly after that, we actually ended up on the shelves of Harrods, which was another anomaly for a frozen food brand, especially one that had come from Dublin and Ireland. Across the US, Walmart, Kroger, Whole Foods, Wegmans, Fresh Markets, Sprouts, a lot in the national channel. I'm sorry to anyone who I'm leaving out. But starting off in, you know, New York and Morton Williams and the small bodegas and Union Market in particular was our first listing in the US. Albert Heijn in the Netherlands, Woolworths in Australia, Cronin in Iceland, Casino in France. Put me on the spot here. Whenever you start doing lists, it's the ones that you don't say that you're going to get in trouble for.
Are you working on, I'm thinking just on France, on Carrefour, for example?
We don't work with Carrefour in France yet, but we work with Carrefour in the UAE.
Okay.
In the UAE, we work with Carrefour and Spinneys and Waitrose. And we've got a number of retailers that we exist with in Hong Kong and Singapore as well. Have been working out there for a while.
So this might be a little bit of a controversial question.
Don't ask it.
when do you think we'll see one of those big retailers, perhaps one of the ones that you're working with, go completely plant-based straight vegan?
I think that question depends on the consumer. I mean, the big retailers are great at following what the consumer trend is because they have the data to understand what's important to their shopper base. And that's what they exist to be, you know, to serve the consumer. If you look at Waitrose and Sainsbury's, for example, they've created a B Corp aisle because they know that that's important to their consumers. So can an aisle become a supermarket? Well, if the aisle or the section didn't exist before, then why not? In terms of timing, I think it becomes about when things start getting complicated for us in terms of global temperature and lack of supply of specific things. I haven't experienced it much, but I've been seeing photos from the team of the UK in particular after Brexit and during the pandemic with empty shelves of day-to-day items.
Yeah.
I have two young children, one of which is still using baby formula. And even as someone in the food business, I'm currently looking in various different stores for the brand that myself and my wife use for him for baby formula. Like, you know,
yeah,
these things are warning signs of change. And, you know, unfortunately, we as a race of people don't do anything until it's right in front of us and causing a problem. And as the problems increase, hopefully it hits home more. But change has been difficult in that respect because it hasn't been forced onto people. And I don't know what the timeline is. I think the sooner the better, obviously, is the right answer. But how it happens, yeah, I'm not sure.
I mean, I'd like to see supermarkets become more visionary. Like, I guess my point, like, if you were, I don't know, going to ask Steve Jobs, if he was still alive, you know, what does a consumer want? They don't know what they want until you give them something. So in a way, it's still like kind of like they're only going to buy what's been marketed to them or what's on the shelves. Yeah. One of the big supermarkets needs to make a decision on this, is my feeling. They really.
Well, I mean, if you look at this from an investment potential perspective, this is a good example because I've seen him on your show, which is Veggie Grill, which is literally two doors down from our office here in Flatiron in New York. There was no vegan vegetarian options on this street or probably in the next three or four blocks other than you going into a deli and asking for them to make you something specific. Yes. Since they've opened, there's five other chains opened on our street, which cater to vegan vegetarian restaurants. Yeah. And they didn't exist before. And I think you're right. You know, if someone started a vegan supermarket, everyone would use it. So I think it's a case of when and not how, because as the options on the main streets change, people are just adapting, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Your point that you made to me about the Starbucks surcharge on plant-based milk before our call, you know, that isn't that great that that's a debate and an argument, because it didn't exist before.
Totally. Yeah.
There was no option before, and now there's seven plant-based milks, and you know that's progress. That's progress.
Yeah, and even like I'm just thinking near where you are now in New York, there's a Shake Shack, and now they want to cater to the plant-based audience by offering their milkshakes with plant-based milk. But yeah, that's an important point that we want to obviously transition the traditional, you know, even like dairy companies, fast food companies to do that. And we do need to follow, because they're at the end of the day, the consumers are going to be making the purchase decisions. But when you have a large supermarket chain that is, and this will come, I think this will lead us to the next questions, which is around farming. You know, they're paying the farmers, and in this scenario, it'll be, if we're thinking of animal agriculture, that they're keeping their livelihoods going. But it's also a reason of why farmers can transition now to grow crops, to grow more vegetables, to grow oats for oat milk, and transition their animal farming, whether it's even, I don't know, a chicken coop into growing mushrooms. So we need a way of this to happen. And I feel that supermarkets have a role in this transition, and it's not just the consumers.
Mm-hmm. No, definitely. Look, it's a combined effort. I'm not suggesting that everyone should just wait for each other to move. But on the basis of how price sensitive shopping has become and the competitive nature between the chains, I don't blame the leadership for not taking the first step. You know what I mean? From one CEO to another, it's almost, you know, falling on the sword to make progress happen. So I think, you know, and that's where they need a strong board. A strong board, plenty of cash reserves, and the willingness to actually change. You know, that those commercial decisions are difficult to make. You know, I've been at the top of the tree for some of those, and sometimes you have to make a difficult decision.
And I guess that's what's also led the growth to now seeing vegan and plant-based online brands picking up, right? So obviously here in the UK, you've got The Vegan Kind. You've also now got a delivery service called Zebra here in the UK for plant-based deliveries, like those other chains that are selling quick turnaround items. But also in the US, you've got Veggie as well, also in the Canadian market. So they started to grow, and there's definitely evidence in that the appetite for consumers is there. Let's talk about your farming background within the family that's been in the, you know, the agriculture industry. So what did they say when you said to them that, you know, you're not eating meat and two veg, you're just going to have the two veg?
We for any farmer that knows me, that sees this, this is the first thing they'll say is he was never a farmer. And that's, that's true. I've grown up working in an agribusiness, working directly with farmers, doing a lot of contract growing, and being involved in the process. But just to be clear, you know, the only time that I actually did any farming specifically was when, at the very start of this venture, David Flynn, who's a great farmer out in Rush, which is an area in North County Dublin where it's got incredibly rich sandy soil. A lot of new crop potatoes and salad vegetables and stuff are grown in that region. It's kind of like Boston or Ely in the UK where they grow potatoes. He helped me grow sweet potatoes because I wanted to understand what the conditions were. Everything was being grown in North Carolina at the time. I wanted to see if we could grow a crop in Ireland outdoor. There was another botanist called Pat Fitzgerald who helped us with the seeds and stuff for that. But ultimately, we proved that it just wasn't going to be possible and there wasn't enough glasshouses to do it. So that's the extent of my farming background, just to be honest about it. What I do know and understand is how products get made. And I mean from the ground all the way to the consumer. And I think that's what's helped us get to where we are over a relatively short space of time, and incredibly lean with a small team, as opposed to having to raise huge tracts of money and you know, lots of consultants in order to do that. From that comes a respect for products. So we've only ever worked with partners that have regenerative programs that aren't overusing the soil, are reusing water, are turning their vegetable waste into biogas in order to power the compressors for energy, and making decisions, you know, including McCain, who have this incredible goal of being carbon neutral and completely sustainable, but I think it's 2030 or 2035. I'm not quite sure. I can't remember. But the goals and the route to get there for a company of that size, you know, means a huge amount of planning and a critical path that can actually do it. So we've always worked with partners that also get it. Like there's lots of times where I've gone into co-manufacturing facilities because we don't make our own things. We design them, we bring them to someone else and they make them for us with our guidance. We've got agronomists on the payroll, we've got engineers on the payroll, but they can only guide and direct the people who are actually doing it. And we've gone into these facilities and, you know, not only is there no food safety, but it's just about if I make enough, I can make the profit. And those companies are already unsustainable and failing. And I don't mean failing from a sustainability perspective, I mean from a business perspective. If you're not thinking about how you can tick all of those boxes and you're not resourced and capitalized to do it, it's only a matter of time before, you know, the business has to cease for you. Because for anyone who's setting up manufacturing facilities or agriculture facilities that are not thinking this way are only going to last a couple of seasons. And then, you know, where the soil comes in, the increase in demand for consumption is constant. You know, we're trying to get to a point where feeding 9 billion people at 2050 needs to be sustainable. And in order to do that, we need to have sustainable crops that are not taking from the planet health, but actually helping sequester things like carbon dioxide from the environment. The reality is that the easiest way to do that, and I know you've seen the great documentary called Kiss the Ground, which goes into detail on this, is essentially by growing plant crops that can help. You know, leaving crops in the ground, less tilling, less water usage, and ultimately more soil health, which means that we need to use less land to grow more volume to feed more people. And like, it's incredibly simple, but the practices that are going on in the agriculture community because of the lack of education are the opposite to this.
And
that's amazing to say, because it's been done for, you know, farming has been done for so long, and most of the people in farming are multi-generational families. But the reality is that resources are being drained, and we have to fix that. As you said, a big advocate for bio sequestration of carbon dioxide by simply getting people to eat more veggies and thus having more plants on the ground. It sounds ridiculously simple, but that's what we need to do.
We were speaking about Kiss the Ground. So if anyone hasn't watched that, it's definitely a good documentary to watch that explains effectively when you're plowing the land, you're also letting off the emissions that have been captured in the soil, whereas you can get certain machinery, which is slicing, if you like, channels at a certain angle where the water can seep through, and then natural water can go into land, and then you don't have these dry patches of land. So it's a great documentary for anyone who hasn't seen that, but it was great to talk to you about that as well. Let's speak about soil health. So obviously, you know, there's also been some documentaries around rewilding and how animal grazing, and then also them with their like cow manure, you know, going into the ground is beneficial for the ground and for soil health. What's your views on that? And especially for me, it's also something that I consider when I'm buying soil. Like, should I buy vegan soil that doesn't have crushed bones or feathers for nitrogen, for example, for the soil? So what are your views on those two areas, the sort of the rewilding aspect of animal grazing and that soil health, but also having organic soil that is also vegan, that doesn't include byproducts from animals?
Big believer in rewilding for areas that can sustain it and that can also have the circular economy of the animal inclusion. Obviously, we don't need to let everything go wild and have an unsustainable mass manufacturing capability for the provision of food. It won't work if it's all that way, unless people eat completely seasonally, which is another huge education piece that people have moved away from historically as opposed to toward.
Right.
I've actually had some amazing conversations with the guys at Wild Farmed, which is a rewilding project, ultimately creating a incredibly high quality flour that's been used in a number of French and London bakeries, which was set up by Andy Cato. And I've had some great conversations with them in the last year or so about what they're trying to do and how it could possibly be done on a wider scale in a bigger environment like the US. When it comes to the need for nitrogen, I think it's completely necessary for the use of animal waste. Again, back to that circular economy. There's no bones, feathers, different conversation, but the use of fertile animal waste in order to naturally fertilize and encourage growth, I think, is something that, you know, has always been in existence. Companies who choose to do it in a less than ethical way is a different conversation.
So that's what I was going to touch on. Like, would you see, you know, having that come from a big producer, factory farm, from animals, and that waste coming from there? Or are you really saying, well, if they're, you know, for example, organic cattle
I think the answer is we can make it ourselves, right? You know,
yeah.
I think there's enough, depending on what your circumstances are, this is something that can be made relatively easily from composting and from your local farm if you wanted to get enough of it. Probably for free in most cases to do that yourself. Mm. No, I wouldn't suggest that. Large factory farming of animals is ultimately beneficial to what we're all trying to achieve here, to move towards plant-based. Mm. But ultimately, we're also trying to, you know, our sort of company philosophy is not to the eradication of anything. It's about eating more veggies as opposed to trying to remove things from your diet, because we want to be realistic about what type of a gateway that we can become for plant-based consumption. So the increased consumption of veggies is what we're about, as opposed to the eradication of it. I'm not personally growing anything out our back because we don't have enough room, but I think personal composting is probably the answer if it's something that's, you know, individually anyone's having an issue with.
Yeah, going to now, you know, future products for you. So obviously you know you're working really hard and doing really well to conquer the frozen food aisle with your veggies and different types of products. What product range are you thinking of next?
It's a great question. We have a number of things on our a pipeline that are going to launch later this year. So at the start of H2, we're going to move into a new category for us, which is what's traditionally called in America as single serve entrees. In the UK, they'd be better known as ready meals. We have developed a range of vegan, ridiculously tasty, nutritious, you know, great source of protein, fiber, products that are completely clean. When we say clean, we mean without any unnatural products whatsoever, which still tastes really delicious. And we've achieved the taste by using natural seasonings. The sugars and the tastes and the textures that are coming from the various vegetables in the products are basically doing all of the work of all of the seasonings that you would normally find in kind of over-processed food. So the first two SKUs that we're launching in Whole Foods nationally in the US are our Thai green veg curry.
Oh, great.
And we have a Greek orzo pasta bake. And we're getting, you know, the savory tastes from roasted cherry tomatoes and using coconut creams in replacement of dairy products.
Yeah.
And for all of the sweetness or any of the spice, we're just using completely natural ingredients, of which you'd be amazed is incredibly difficult when you're trying to mass manufacture products, mostly because most factories are now using so many allergens and using so many ingredients in food instead of trying to really simplify them down to make a basic proposition of stuff that already tastes good. It's amazing how overcomplicated the cooking process has become in mass manufacturing, to the point where, you know, everyone's using stabilizers or loads of salt or loads of sugar to make things taste great. And we think we've cracked it without having to use any of that. So those two products go live. There's another four products that'll follow those up in the US market. And we're currently investigating whether that's going to be the next proposition for the UK and Irish markets as well.
Yeah.
So we're really excited about those. And what that does is it gives us the potential to disrupt a massive industry in the US. You know, we want to continue to be a challenger brand. And one of the biggest places that, in our opinion, hasn't been innovated in at least the last 20 years properly is that entree or ready meal aisle, with really tasty but really healthy and clean at the same time, and balanced nutrition. So we're going to start with kind of meal centers, things that you would eat at lunchtime or dinner. But we're also going to look at breakfast and snacking and, you know, post gym protein moments and everything else that goes with it. So yeah, we're really excited about that new meal for one category with those two products launching soon.
Sounds great. I will look forward to try them. Maybe when I'm next in the US or in the UK, depending on which products you're launching here.
We'll send you some before. Don't worry.
Yeah. As long as you package it in an environmentally friendly way, then that's cool.
It's been a big part of the decision process. You know, we're trying to figure out whether completely compostable card, which is ultimately really strained from a supply source at the moment.
And right.
Obviously cutting down too many trees is not what our objective is. Yeah. One of the most circular supply chains that we've come across specifically is with PET. So plastic, but the right density for constant recycling over and over again, up to 15 times. So, you know, trying to make those decisions about what goes into the supply chain has been a huge part of the R&D. Normally we turn things around in, you know, 6 months. This has taken about 24.
Yeah. Actually, I was reading about that as well. Is it PHA? Is that something else? Another form?
Oh, don't put me on the spot.
Yeah, okay.
I know a lot of the letters, but not all of them.
Yeah, me either. All right, Sam. This has been a pleasure talking with you. And you've done so much great stuff. We're really looking forward to seeing the new products that you're bringing to market. And just getting more consumers to eat whole food as much as we can. It's an exciting range of flavors that you start to introduce to get to more scale. I want to see you in a lot more markets and then hopefully get you back on the show to tell us all the progress that you've made.
I'd love that. Thanks for having me on. It's been really great chatting with you.
Awesome. Thanks very much and see you again soon.
See you soon.
Take care. Bye.